The Falling Middle Cast is a spin-off series from the creators of Mars on Life. This series provides review and commentary of Barbara Ehrenreich's Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Since this series analyzes the text and provides a critique on class in America, this is not a comprehensive audiobook and follows all copyright claims. Now, back to the show.
But enough about my job. We're here to talk about the stereotype on the screen. Chapter 3, section, I hope you've been keeping track at this point. If sociology creates the official stereotypes, as Ryan goes to desperately search for it, Hollywood and the networks. Okay. Hollywood and the networks create the ones we know best. No sooner had the news media discovered the working class and found it to be reactionary, bigoted, and male, than the scriptwriters set to work to exploit the entertainment possibilities of this interesting new social grouping. Roughly speaking, television was drawn to its humorous possibilities, Hollywood to its supposed potential for violence. The result was two overlapping images. On television, the blue-collar male as buffoon, and in the movies, the blue-collar buffoon as mass murderer. I typically find that, like, white-collar crime made up a predominantly high percentage of, like, mass-murdering psychopaths. Like, I wouldn't consider American Psycho blue-collar. In fact, that's probably the biggest far cry from that.
Well, I don't think she's referring to, I mean, I don't even think American Psycho was a thing yet when this book came out.
Well, I don't think she's talking about Hobo with a Shotgun either.
No, but there is plenty of media out there, including one of my favorite just random 70s movies, The Taking of Pelham 123, where it's basically just it's just like a group of schmoes that are like, okay, we're gonna hold this train hostage and we're gonna reach out to the schmoes that work for the New York whatever transit authority. And basically be like, you know, oh no, listen here, we want this much cash, this much money, and you better deliver it quickly. And the reason why I'm doing this voice is because Robert Shaw was one of them, i.e. Chiefy. So it's a great movie, but it really emphasizes just how schlubby everyone is, down to the point where, I kid you not, one of the guys that holds the train hostage is Wilson from Home Improvement.
Oh, hell yeah.
And the two guys that Robert Shaw is dealing with in the, like, transit authority are Walter Matthau, who's basically the star of the movie, and his co-worker, a young comedian by the name of Jerry Stiller.
This is Frank Costanza.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Seinfeld has entered the chat. The Falling Middle Cast chat.
I'm going to continue before this gets veered off into a tangent that, of course, will be a one-sided conversation, because knowing you, of course it will be.
And she provides examples, so don't jump the gun there.
The blue collar and, of course, white buffoon, best represented by Norman Lear's Archie Bunker, was perhaps the inevitable replacement for the perennial African-American buffoon represented by Amos and Andy. For decades, African-American stereotypes had been natural targets for white derision, their racial otherness augmented by rural simple-mindedness, among other things, I'm sure. But by the 60s, the civil rights movement had revealed, quote, racial humor as racist, or at the very least, tasteless and declassé. Sorry, I don't speak Spanish. Besides, most African Americans were no longer country folk with amusing drawls. They were, or were increasingly represented as, fast talking, street smart urbanites. So no more Bubba from Forrest Gump. In the early 70s, quote, black exploitation films such as Superfly And countless other the one instance that I've heard of Superfly is in that 2016, either 2014 to 2016 movie, Dope. It's about a kid who sell a bunch of drugs on the black black market. It's pretty good. It's actually really good. Year is kind of leaving me at the moment, though. African Americans have both the mental edge and the fashion advantage. They dress slickly and expensively, hustle for a living, and dispense a cynical wisdom unattainable through the supposedly safe, bland experience of whites. Well, this podcast just went in the toilet. All our commentary has gone to shit then, if that's the case. You're saying I gotta be hip to the jive in order to make good commentary? I'm sure that's not what she's saying.
Don't make me get Barbara Billingsley from Airplane here. It's June Cleaver, I tell you. Talking jive.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the white middle Americans had, in fleeting to the suburbs, come to seem like a new kind of peasantry. In the stereotypes of the entertainment media, they were ill at ease in the city, ignorant of hip urban slang, and preoccupied with the most degenerate form of agriculture, lawn maintenance, which ironically most whites don't do themselves, but, you know, urban African Americans were setting styles in music, language, and clothing. Middle Americans were prone to such fashion errors as white socks and checkered slacks. The demographic upheavals of the 50s, the African American migration northward, and white flight to the suburbs, followed by the African American insurgency of the 60s, had one seldom noted cultural consequence. Jokes about N-words became archaic and unfunny. You gotta love this. And Polish jokes took their place. All in the Family, the sitcom featuring Archie Bunker, was the longest running Polish joke of all. Bunker, Carol O'Connor, was not Polish, of course, nor a member of any identifiable ethnic group. By 1970, when the show premiered, a comedy targeting any particular white ethnic group might have faced pickets and boycotts. But as middle-class prejudice would have it, Archie was parochial, patriarchal, ignorant, and given to gross malapropisms. For example, he paid taxes to the Infernal Revenue Service. And as the conventional interpretation of the backlash would have it, he was belligerently racist, anti-Semitic, hawkish, and God. I need to say this in my conservative talk radio announcer's voice, but I don't think I have the stomach for it. He was belligerently racist, anti-Semitic, hawkish, and deeply threatened by, quote, women's libbers and hippies. The show was popular and controversial, and especially controversial because it was so popular. Imagine that. Did people watch it to laugh at Archie? Or did the friction of hearing him utter illicit epithets like, of course, the N-word and the K-word, four-letter word.
But you'll say the F-word.
Well, you can bleep that. Or do they simply want to be reassured that, however, bitter arguments between Archie and his liberal professionally-oriented son-in-law, this unaccustomed political turmoil was still, quote, all in the family? The effect, though, was to impress the blue-collar stereotype onto a generation of viewers. Well into the 80s, literate and often quite liberal people would use All in the Family as a major sociological reference point and refer to white working class males conveniently as the Archie Bunker types. So we're moving away from the whole Norman Rockwellian nuclear family, and we've now affixed a new name for it. Is that what she's saying?
Well,
or has it just taken on a more modern for the time definition?
Well, it's putting a face to what the Norman Rockwell family evolved into. Or at the very least, I mean, that's just it. Norman Rockwell family is so, like, who does it represent, you know, from a class standpoint? Like, what typical American does it represent? I would argue it would represent more of the, maybe not so much affluent, but certainly more upper middle class family. Whereas if it is your typical blue collar working class family, or somebody like Archie Bunker, then it's a little bit harder for me to see it as a Norman Rockwell. It's hard for me to see it represented by Norman Rockwell's work.
Okay.
Just my thoughts.
No, it's a great observation. I'm just wondering if it if it's a different definition altogether, or if it just sort of molded into what the sign of the times were. Mm. 1970s Joe, Hollywood's first major contribution to the stereotype, was Archie Bunker with an armory. When we first met him, Joe, Peter Boyle, is knocking back Boilermakers in a rundown Queens bar, declaiming, for anyone who will listen, a litany of classic backlash sentiments.
Oh, dear God.
Well, I'm going to try to read this as best as possible. And in, I guess, in respect for the drawl, as was mentioned earlier, I'm not going to say it in that much of a stereotyped accent. However, what I will do is say it in my, I guess, cookie cutter corporate customer service voice while bleeping out what I need to. The N-words are getting all the money. Why work? You tell me, why the fuck work when you can screw, have babies, and get paid for it? The social workers. Ever notice that? They're all N-word lovers. I sweat my balls off 40 hours a week. But the blacks set fire to the cities and you get paid for it. Throw a few bombs and you get paid for it. Liberals. 42% of all liberals are queer. The rich white kids, hippies, sugar tit all the way. Sex, drugs, pissing on America. I'd like to kill one of them.
Holy crap!
Whew, I felt my inner Sean Hannity come out there for a second. I mean, I did my best, you know, but I really
like
tried
a
to tone
it. Rabid version of that neighbor of mine. Ooh. It's like, yes, Bill, let the werewolf come out.
In the end, he does kill perhaps a half dozen of them, huddled helplessly in a rural commune. But until that ghastly climax, it is hard to know whether Joe is meant to be a joke or a public menace. Like Archie, he is a buffoon. He pronounces orgy with a hard G, and is clearly as eager to participate in one as to annihilate the hippies who, at least in this movie, party night and day. Even the soundtrack mocks him with a folksy refrain. Hey Joe, don't it make you want to go to war once more? But unlike Archie, who would be perversely lovable even at his nastiest, there is something dangerously off about Joe. When he learns that an African-American family has moved in down the block, with real nice furniture, quote, for coloreds, his wife explained soothingly, he goes down into the basement to stroke his guns. When he happens to meet someone who has actually killed a hippie, a well-off executive who has murdered his daughter's drug dealer boyfriend, he becomes obsessively attached to his improbable new pal. Joe emerges as a maniac who has been barely kept in line by his pallid marriage and dull job, and it's easy to forget, as the plot fades from memory, that in Joe, it was the executive and not the steelworker who first killed a hippie, and who, in the final bloodbath, shoots his own daughter. I was getting ahead of myself, because the next example, Taxi Driver, oh, phenomenal movie, and arguably one that I think does this a little bit more tastefully, carried the theme of the demented worker one step further. Travis Bickle, Robert De Niro, represents the working class in a stage of surreal degeneration. He has no visible family, no real friends, no union worth mentioning, no on-the-job camaraderie. Here, the limited associations and parochial world of the working class have narrowed down to one man in a filthy apartment.
Mine's Travis is clean.
Mine's clean. Oh. Oh, man. Oh, this, man, I think it's... I once read somewhere that it's like every white guy's villain arc to watch the movie Drive, Cocaine Cowboys, or Taxi Driver, and then center a whole personality around that in his mid to late 20s. I don't know if you've heard that, but it's just amazing how many times I've heard it.
I've heard variations of it. I know
it's basically like you're playing in your own Hotline Miami, where you're at the center of your own universe and everyone's sort of out to get you.
And it's also like this
vigorous vigilantism is the key to find fulfillment.
Well, and it strips away, you know, she makes it abundantly clear, it strips away any class consciousness, and it instead it strips it of anything that would be deemed you know, some kind of leftist analysis and decides, okay, we're just going to go straight for the nihilism. And but typically it's the nihilism that either goes towards some kind of bent towards oblivion or oblivion everywhere else for the sake of success. Because on top of all these other movies, the other movie that I've mentioned many a time on Mars on Life that also gets thrown into the mix, especially with the relationship with Drive and with Taxi Driver, is Nightcrawler. It's a similar kind of premise because it is a similar kind of character like Travis Bickle. And obviously, since 2019, Joker gets thrown into the equation as well.
Right.
I mean, let's face it.
Right.
Martin Scorsese basically, like, bequeathed Joker, and the movie is clearly an inspiration. It's clearly inspired by Taxi Driver, so.
Mm-hmm. Travis is even stupider than Joe or Archie. When asked in the opening interview for the taxi job whether he is, quote, moonlighting, it is clear that he has no idea what that odd compound word means. He does not read newspapers and demonstrates his impatience with TV by kicking his set over during a tedious love scene. He has been deprived by the scriptwriters of even a reactionary ideology to focus his rage. Below him is the chaotic street life of drug dealing and prostitution, represented by a pimp who exploits underage girls. Above him is the cold, condescending world of the middle class, represented by a presidential candidate who insists on speaking in a phony populist first person plural about how we the people suffered in Vietnam from unemployment, etc. It's a toss-up which one of these sleazy characters Travis will turn his homicidal fury on first. The climactic scene, as in Joe, is mayhem. Bodies everywhere, blood dripping from the walls and forming puddles on the floor. But Travis is at peace. This blue-collar worker has finally, and for reasons inscrutable to the audience, done his work. Reminds me of the second part of that meme where it's like, I think it's every young man's dream, I guess, like fever dream to like die in combat or something. I don't know. I think more people need to spend less time on Reddit and in a therapy ward. In Hollywood's decade-long meditation on the working class, roughly 1970 to the early 80s, blue-collar environments like war zones were invariably settings for masculine mayhem. Oh, okay, I get it. Like blue-collar environment. Okay. Because it's like appealing to, I hate to use this example, because I don't think I represent the majority, both in like physical capability as well as just in mental capacity, like jarheads, basically. Like the Marines love to fight kind of thing, like kill, like
right.
War zones. So I'm assuming that's what's being referred to here.
I don't know if I fully get
like blue-collar environments, blue-collar being innately lower to middle lower class.
Well, I know that, but you mean like the setting, like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, think of a good example that comes to mind, and it's arguably one of the best examples that comes to mind, just because it's typically when I do think in my spare time when I think of a blue collar war zone. I'm just kidding. But like one good movie that's an example would be They Live, where a lot of the fighting is very much on the streets amongst a bunch of people that are. Or I guess amidst a bunch of people that are, you know, working class folks bordering on homelessness that are basically realizing they're going to have to wage guerrilla warfare against this alien-run society that is just continuously pushing them down or telling them to conform. Mm-hmm. And they realize they can't take the fight to them, so they're going to bring the enemy to them and basically fight on their level.
Okay, so it's basically like, it's basically the plot of Half-Life then. Got it.
Sure.
As someone who doesn't play video games, I'm just going to ask for you to go along with that. It really is like that, though. It's set in like a QZ, like a quarantine zone, and it's this it's aliens coming to Earth, and we need to just live by their not obedience, but like, hey, you better. It's Last of Us, basically. It's not a good environment. Anyway, Hollywood's blue-collar men were at any age perpetual boys, embracing, punching each other's biceps, mock wrestling, rolling on the floor together, all with the masculine exuberance that most white-collar men would have left behind in high school, or if they didn't bother to step into a Planet Fitness. Just kidding, you don't work out there. In Blue Collar, 1978, the auto worker heroes, Mr. White himself, Harvey Keitel, Richard Pryor, and Yuff.
Oh my god.
What, it's Harvey Keitel?
It's Keitel.
Is it Keitel?
It
I'm
is
sorry.
Keitel.
Everyone that I've ever met pronounces it Keitel. I see the I in there, so I'm not ignorant to that fact.
It's Keitel.
I've just heard it be pronounced Keitel more than Keitel. I'll do better. Okay. Please don't flag me on your social media. I'm doing my best. Okay, then you know what? Pronounce this last name for me.
Yaphet After Kotto.
Yaphet Kotto. Okay. Thank God.
Right, he was in Alien. He was in, I think, one of the Elm Street movies, and he's also the bad guy in Live and Let Die.
Oh, get out of here. Mm-hmm. Okay. The auto worker heroes drink, horse around, and even have what Joe would have called an orgy altogether. But in Hollywood, there is always an element of danger in blue-collar hijinks. In The Deer Hunter, 1979, the steelworker heroes, Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken, among others, get into an improperly childish quarrel over a pair of hunting boots. A gun is drawn. And after the hunt, though tensions subside, when they all shake up their cans of Rolling Rock and squirt each other in a kind of phallic play appropriate to a junior high school locker room. In Saturday Night Fever, 1977, Tony Manero, John Travolta, and his friends carry the horseplay too far. When one of them dies in a fall from the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, Tony starts thinking of upward mobility. His working-class environment has become a health hazard. And more often, the working class itself is a monstrous threat, like the savage slaughterhouse workers in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, who were described by critic Robin Wood as, quote, an exploited and degraded proletariat, preying on the affluent young. I'm going to have to rewatch Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I've heard it's campy to the point that it's just not borderline unwatchable, but it's always the justification of I have better things to watch with my time. I don't see many people going back to the original, but I do see people holding a candle for the original because who's going to say classic movies are bad? In Looking for Mr. Goodbar, 1977, the heroine, Diane Keaton, is undone by her taste for murderous blue-collar hunks. In Assault on Precinct 13, 1976, a refreshingly interracial blue-collar army attacks the police in a human wave, much like the masses of zombies in Night of the Living Dead. The difference between war zones and blue-collar settings is that in Hollywood's wars, boys become men. In the blue-collar world, men become boys, often very bad boys.
I'm the bad boy.
And are likely to remain so for life. I'm surprised they didn't mention Full Metal Jacket here. I mean, sure, you have in both acts sort of like the duality of man once it showcases what the Marines are training for and what eventually will come to be in the field. But that's like, I'm not going to say that's the perfect example, but it's at least a good example.
I don't know about that, just because I think where she's getting at is with any kind of example of class warfare, there is this assumption that it's not going to be in a stereotypical battlefield of any kind, but it's going to be a literal fight on the streets. I'll bet you, even though it would also be stretching it, like another example she probably would have included had this book come out decades later. And I know this was the director's intention when he made it, to have it be a his weird commentary on class warfare, quote unquote, would be The Dark Knight Rises. Because it is this idea of like this random, out of the blue undercurrent that doesn't represent the 1% of Gotham, basically taking it over within like an afternoon, to the point where like any kind of battle with the police is so one and done But I don't know. I mean, Full Metal Jacket, the thing is I can't see an argument for class consciousness in that one. Whereas with these other examples, I mean, I admittedly don't know enough about Looking for Mr. Goodbar, but The Deer Hunter, Saturday Night Fever, Taxi Driver, all of them are perfect examples of just like how you do narrow it down. I mean, think about it. Auto workers, steel workers, taxi drivers, like it's very mundane jobs that you see the humiliation and the degradation of people that are in these jobs thinking, what more is there to my life when the rest of the world seems to be going to hell? And those people over there are getting benefits, and those people over there are on welfare, and I'm getting nothing. Whereas Full Metal Jacket, like, they're getting everything and nothing at the same time.
Okay.
So
Got it. Got it.
I don't
Got
know,
it.
I could be completely wrong, but that's kind of my
The
take.
violence and roughhousing were symptomatic of another role played by Hollywood's blue-collar men. Like the poor, they symbolize the personal and collective past. They are, first of all, out of style, meaning that their tastes are ones that the middle class has long since abandoned. In a trivial but important way, the archaic condition of the working class is often signaled by food cues. In The Deer Hunter, a story of steel workers drawn from small-town innocence in Vietnam, one of the circle of buddies ceremoniously eats a Twinkie dipped in mustard. It is the Twinkie, all sugar and refined flour, as much as the mustard that caused health-conscious middle-class viewers to giggle. In Twice in a Lifetime, 1985, another tale of steel workers confronted with the challenges of modern life, the camera underscores the hero's proletariat status by drawing our attention to the white bread and Budweiser on the dinner table. It's really what you need at the end of the day. But the most archaic feature of Hollywood's blue-collar men is their values. They are deeply loyal, not to abstract ideals or ethical principles, but to a narrow circle of friends and family. The Deer Hunter is a prolonged celebration of blue-collar male bonding. The Godfather, which is about ethnics, a stereotypical category overlapping with the working class, that's one way to look at it. looking on at that movie as a non-Italian, hinges on primitive allegiances forged in the old country. Very often, movie plots revolve around a test to blue-collar loyalties. Terry Malloy in On the Waterfront has to decide whether to stick with his pals in a corrupt longshoremen's union or adopt the more middle-class outlook of his girlfriend. That's about the plot of Mafia One. Tony Manero has a similar choice between the blue-collar boys or his upwardly mobile dance partner. The construction worker hero of Blood Brothers, 1978, played by Richard Gere. Gere, am I pronouncing that right? I thought I'd bring it back to the expert. Okay, because I was going to say Geary or Gray, even though it doesn't have an accent mark.
That's Jerry. No, just
Jerry
here.
has to choose between his violently dysfunctional family and the therapeutic values represented by a kindly physician. In Twice in a Lifetime, a 50-year-old steelworker, Gene Hackman, no shit, wow, is torn between his tight-knit, family-centered community and his new love. His closest friend and coworker advises him to stay with his wife, his son. Oh, I'm sorry, his son, who has moved into a middle-class occupation and thoroughly modern state of California, advises him to follow his heart. Now, there are two ways to look at the past, or at a social group which has been assigned the symbolic burden of the past, as something to be reformed or overcome, or as something to be reversed and restored. In movies like Blood Brothers, Saturday Night Fever, and Twice in a Lifetime, the archaic blue-collar life must be transcended for more cosmopolitan vistas. But in Rocky, 1976, the hero, described by critic Pauline Kael, as the embodiment of the out-of-fashion pure at heart, triumphs in spirit at least against the cynical cosmopolitan world represented by the African-American champion Apollo Creed. Well, I would say who won in the end, considering all I see now are Creed posters. So,
Fun little fun
yeah.
fact, by the way. Pauline Kael, I think forgot if this was confirmed, but apparently she might be the focus of Quentin Tarantino's quote unquote last movie.
Oh, goody. Yeah, like we haven't heard that eight times. Wasn't his last movie supposed to be like The Hateful Eight or something?
Mm-mm. He said he would stop at 10 movies, so for everybody that forgot how many movies he's done, he put 8 in the title just to be like, okay, okay, did y'all forget? Did y'all forget? There's the name of the movie in the title.
So after The Hateful Eight,
he did
the two movies that followed were...
He did one after.
One that was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the 10th would be, I think the name of it is The Critic.
The Critic.
At least tentatively, that's the name. So, and allegedly, it's supposed to be about Pauline Kael.
Mm-hmm.
That's subject to change. I'm just going off of what.
Interesting.
Hollywood Reporter and who else said so. But anyway, continue.
In The Godfather, the old world values of the mafia patriarch, Marlon Brando, are upheld against his college educated son's cold hearted obsession with the bottom line. You come into here? Into my office, and you're gonna worry about the bottom line of the mob? For shame.
What's the matter with you?
Or something to that effect. I don't know. I just saved you 9 hours, because I'm assuming each movie is 3 hours long.
Just about, yeah.
Yeah. Outside of Hollywood, middle class reveries on the working class began to divide along similar lines during the 1970s. From one point of view, the working class was not only archaic, but obsolete, its boyish violence a sign of arrested development. In The Greening of America, for example, Charles Reich slotted blue-collar men into the lowest stage of consciousness, below white-collar conformists and far below the physically liberated hip types who represented the highest stage of human development. Oh, man. The punch. The working class became, for many middle-class liberals, a psychic dumping ground for such unstylish sentiments as racism, male chauvinism, and crude materialism. Sounds like your neighbor. A rearguard population that loved white bread and hated black people. In the alternative, more conservative view... Oh, that wasn't the conservative view? Oopsies.
Well, yeah, the working class became, for many middle-class liberals...
Yeah, but it says in the alternative, more conservative view. I'm like, wait, that's not who we were talking about?
No, we were talking about what liberals thought of the working class.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Because yeah. I saw racism, male chauvinism, and crude materialism. And I'm like, well, one of these... It's not that one of these sounds... What was that? What's that saying? One of these is not like the other.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this is like all three hit their mark. Anyway, in the alternative, more conservative view, the archaic qualities of the working class were transformed into something precious. The traditional values within the middle class saw slipping from its own grasp. The boyish physicality of the working class stood for a kind of manliness that white-collar professionals had long since surrendered to the bureaucracy. The parochialism of working class life represented an admirable holdout against the intrusions of an increasingly cosmopolitan consumer culture. The economic injustice that made men workers could be interpreted positively as a collective addition to hard work and self-discipline. So this is where the fitness models get their inspiration from. It's about hard work and self-discipline. It's definitely not about cosmopolitan consumer culture. There you go. In this view, the, quote, forgotten working class stood for what the middle class itself had lost, or always seemed to be on the verge of losing, the capacity for self-denial and deferred gratification, the very traits required for middle class success. And both of these views, however, arose out of a common stereotype, and both were confused in the middle class mind with personal memory, regret, and nostalgia. See, to middle class men, the blue-collar stereotype could never be such a distant other as the poor, especially the African-American poor. To look at a male figure associated with the personal and historical past is to find both the father and the son, the man and the boy, someone to look up to and someone to move beyond. Middle-class image of the working class contained both figures and was colored with nostalgia as well as contempt. The Worker, quote unquote, was both a throwback to childish, outmoded values, and he was a collective superego, holding out for hard work, tract houses, and processed food against the mad drift of the psychedelicized culture at large. It helped, of course, that he himself was never invited to participate in the great middle class enterprise of image making and social discovery. So this is why it's so important to have a father figure. No, I'm assuming that the strong traditionalist, I guess, father figure, whether that be biological or otherwise, is where that superego stems from. Not so much Oedipal, where you want to surpass your father in terms of killing him, but basically having your father serve as a baseline of who you want to be, because obviously your father was successful enough to have you. Can't be all bad.
I mean, collectively, looking at this part of the section, it's definitely fascinating to gather any kind of sense of just what America thought of, you know, working class people post 1970, especially after Vietnam, where, like, there was this idea that we all finally, like, homogenized as a country. And to some degree, that was because you had such an overwhelming, you know, an overwhelming reaction, no pun intended, against a lot of what happened in the decade prior. And a large chunk of that reaction, ultimately, you can't avoid the political here, and I know I'm jumping the gun because I can see the bottom of the page. It's what ultimately led to Nixon getting reelected in 1972, where people were just so fed up. And it was like, well, clearly the one guy that seems to have any kind of rationality behind him, despite the fact that he just lied every chance he could, people still bought what he said because they believed in what he said. And they basically thought, well, he's the guy that's still going to turn us around, despite the fact that, you know, again, thanks to Watergate and then also thanks to what came in the hearings after he resigned, that basically proved, Vietnam, we, like, could have left, like, 5 years earlier. And that LBJ lied to us, you know. So it just further united but also further intensified the sense of, like, what direction are we going? And Hollywood's answer to it was, we're just going to represent middle-class Americans either in the most stereotyped ways possible, or wait for somebody like John Carpenter to come along and arguably represent it in the best way possible with They Live. I don't know if you have any additional thoughts to that, or...
Nada. No, let's delve beyond the stereotype. The floor is yours.
Beyond the stereotype, America's blue-collar workers were in revolt in the late 60s and early 70s, but not along the right-wing traditionalist lines sketched by the media. The late 60s saw the most severe strike wave since shortly after World War II, and by the early 70s, the new militancy had swept up auto workers, rubber workers, steel workers, teamsters, city workers, hospital workers, farm workers, tugboat crewmen, gravediggers, and postal employees. For all the talk of racial backlash, African-American and white workers were marching, picketing, and organizing together in a spirit of class solidarity that had not been seen since the 30s. Nixon's silent majority was yelling as loud as it could, not racial epithets, but the historic strikers' chant, "Don't cross the line." And something new was happening among the blue-collar workforce. Young workers, many the same age as the campus rebels, were wearing their hair shoulder length, smoking pot, and beginning to question the totalitarian regimen of factory life. As Stanley Aronowitz reported from the Mammoth GM plant at Lordstown, Ohio, long hair, marijuana, and rock music is shared by nearly all young workers in the plant. Young workers were bringing a new dimension to blue-collar insurgency, a rejection of the endless tedium of assembly work. In the massive 1970 GM strike, in which 400,000 auto workers walked out, the central demand was 30 and out. Retirement at any age after 30 years of service at a generous pension. The blue-collar revolt against work was carried out covertly, outside of union channels. Workers, especially on the grueling auto assembly lines, were staying home on Mondays, getting high at work, and finding ingenious ways to slow down the assembly line and catch a few moments of rest. There was even the possibility in the late 60s of an explosive convergence of the working class insurgency and the student movement. Certainly many student radicals dreamed of such an alliance. And if the powerful also thought of it, they had a reason to fear. All over the world, radical students plus discontented workers, or peasants, had been the classic ingredients of revolution. In France, in 1968, striking students and workers, blue and white collar, almost toppled the government of Charles de Gaulle. American students borrowed many of their tactics, strikes, occupations, from the blue-collar uprisings of the 1930s. And workers in the 60s were catching the anti-authoritarian spirit of the student radicals. The civil rights movement had already spilled over into the African-American industrial working class with the formation of militant groups like the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. When Time reported on the blue-collar blues in 1970 and documented the revolt against boring, repetitive work, it could not resist prefacing the story with the familiar stereotype. Only 2 pages before the observation that young workers are revolting against the job itself, or at least the way it is organized, we find this description of the American worker. As psychologists and social researchers have confirmed, he believes in God and country, if not necessarily an equality, inequality and the right of dissent. He is convinced of the virtues of hard work, the necessity of saving, and a steady, ordered way of life. Sounds like a guy you could get behind.
Yeah. No comment.
In their voting habits, too, blue-collar Americans were not, at the time of their discovery, shifting to the right. Nor was much of anybody, except perhaps for the media people who were now so anxious to document a surge of right-wing populism. The 1968 presidential vote told the story. 50% of manual workers polled voted for Humphrey, 35% for Nixon, and 15% for Wallace. Blue-collar workers had been splitting their votes in similar proportions for a dozen years. In the 1956 presidential election, 50% voted Democratic and 50% Republican. In contrast, only 34% of the supposedly more liberal, professional, and business class voted Democratic in 1968, up only 2 percentage points from 1956. There was no excuse for omitting these facts from the media's 1969 discovery of the working class. Whatever provocation it had supposedly endured from militant African Americans, hippies, or student protesters, the blue-collar working class remained steadfastly more liberal than the middle class, at least on the major economic and foreign policy issues that distinguished the parties. Even Kevin Phillips, the conservative strategist who optimistically announced the emerging Republican majority in 1969, had to admit that the blue-collar vote was Democratic and that it was so by reason of clear-cut class interests. Fears that a Republican administration would undermine Social Security, Medicare, collective bargaining, and aid to education played a major part in keeping socially conservative blue-collar workers and senior citizens loyal to the 1968 Democratic candidate. And in their exhaustive analysis of the 1968 election results, Richard M. Scammon and Ben J. Wattenberg firmly insisted that the class contours of American politics remained what they had always been. The elite of doctors, bankers, and businessmen was Republican, while those plain people who work with their hands were Democratic. Boy, have times changed.
I was going to say, I often feel like Republicans like to believe that the opposite is the case, where they come from such a humble background, right? Maybe that once was the case. However, it's clear that the occupational shift has been shifted, and it's more or less, yes, you oftentimes find that certain individuals fall into certain positions. I guess my question is, why do they keep pushing this humble bootstrapping narrative? Is it just to appeal?
I don't know if you were going to say any more.
No. I'm just wondering why push the narrative.
Why push the narrative that they that either the Republicans or the Democrats are the party for plain people,
Right.
based on this? Well,
Right.
it's primarily the idea that both these parties know that their party membership and who they represent are not the people that they actually need the votes from. So, for the most part, reaching out to middle America, where for the most part is not registered to either party, and for the most part votes with their wallets, and for the most part decides that, okay, we don't have party loyalty, but we just want to make sure that somebody's actually going to come along and change things and fix things. They can go either way. And I mean, that's how you get so many Obama voters that voted for Trump in 2016 and then switched back to Biden in 2020. So, and obviously 2020's, at least in my opinion, it's an exception just because so many more people voted. Thanks, COVID. Like I said, it's both parties just realizing that the people they actually need the votes from, they do not represent. And so they will go out of their way and be all, yeah, I'm the most working class president we've ever had in century, Jack. And then, 2 years earlier, the Republican Party is the working class party. We're for you. We're for the people. So it just becomes something where it's just a talking point. It doesn't mean anything, but if the president, the incumbent, really sucks, and the competition is basically appealing to that voter, then they're gonna see that presidential candidate and think, well, maybe I should vote for him. It's a simple take, but
It's the best we got at this point.
It's an older take, sir, but it certainly
It
checks
checks
out.
out. Yes. I get the reference.
Thank
I've
you.
seen the wars that have taken place in space.
Okay. Nor was there any evidence in 1969 of a general middle American shift to the right. It is true, as Phillips and Scammon and Wattenberg emphasized, that most Americans were conservative on what they termed the social issues: crime, obscenity, demonstrations, drug use. Over 80% of Americans polled in 1968 wanted stricter laws on obscenity, a stronger stand on student disorders, and opposed the legalization of marijuana. These opinions hardly represent a shift, since even 4 years earlier there were no student demonstrations and no nude or pot smoking hippies to disturb public sensibilities.
I don't even
I'm
think
more.
that stereotype exists now. I feel like you oftentimes come to the conclusion that there are more high functioning white collar individuals who will kind of take a toke, and that this I can't imagine what an individual would do who has this sort of stereotyped perspective of like, hey, look, it's the otherism. And then come to find out he strolls his way into the office and finds out that Jerry's taking it. Oh, Jerry smells like marijuana, but he's supposed to be that high functioning accountant.
Well, and it's also this idea that the candidates that these people will vote for, they're such upstanding citizens that of course they wouldn't smoke weed or get
Right.
naked or whatever. But the whole idea is that the affluent are going to go out of their way and do the kinds of things that the rest of us either are inclined to do or are tempted to do or want to experiment with doing. But the idea is, oh no, little person, little man, you can't do that, but I can because my wallet is the size of a cheeseburger, whereas you are poor and pathetic and you can't smoke pot or be obscene or whatever. So I mean,
Okay.
it's billions basically. It's Paul Giamatti can have somebody pee on him, but not the rest of us. That was the first scene I saw in that
Weird
show, and it was the
example.
last scene I saw in that
A
show.
weird example. I mean, I'm all right, man. You're into what you're into. Would that fall under obscenity? I wonder.
I
You know what
mean,
you know what I think I might go towards that middle American shift then.
there was a single legitimate excuse for declaring a rightward shift among the blue-collar working class, it was George Wallace, who sought the presidency as an independent in 1964, 68, and 72. To the national media, he was a foreign and repellent presence, and this sounds familiar, with his heavily brilliantined hair. That really sounds familiar. Huge red jeweled Masonic ring and defiant mispronunciations, e.g. report for rapport. But to his followers, he was a working-class rebel whose campaign literature raised the defiant question, can a former truck driver who married a former dime store clerk and whose father was a plain dirt farmer be elected president of the United States?
The answer is no.
Yeah, thank goodness. In the summer and fall of 1968, Wallace was showing strong support among white northern blue-collar workers. A September Gallup poll found 25% of the nation's union members prepared to vote for him, and a survey of white males in the smokestack city of Gary, Indiana, found 38% of blue-collar men for Wallace compared to 12.6% of white-collar men. Worse, some polls suggested that the more a person identified himself, or more rarely herself, as working class, the more likely he or she was to support this apparently racist and right-wing upstart. Trade union and Democratic Party leaders were alarmed. The workers were expected to follow their union's instructions and vote for the Democratic candidate, Hubert Humphrey. But here they were, breaking ranks to follow a third-party maverick whose ideology was being nervously compared to fascism. To middle-class liberals, blue-collar support for Wallace was another case of the politics of unreason. Even in our well-educated society, an article in the liberal Christian Century commented condescendingly, it is a mistake to assume that voters are rational people. And I should point out, well, Wallace did run as a Republican in the past. Oh, shoot. I think I'm wrong on that. No, because he was a Dixiecrat. I take that back. He was a Dixiecrat. The parties were terrified of him, and the Republicans were extra terrified because they were like, our candidate might be a little too close to what this guy's all about. So, and I'm sure you caught it, but where it said trade union and Democratic Party leaders were alarmed, this obviously prefacing the fact that this was still at a time when unions and union members and the working class in general typically voted Democrat because of the New Deal. That was the ongoing relationship that only fell further apart by the time the 70s hit, and by 1980 it completely shattered. How that fixed itself again in by 1992 is still kind of beyond me, but I guess you had enough Gen Xers that were like, oh, Bill Clinton's cool, man.
I knew you'd be back.
Yeah. I know where that's from.
Yeah.
You know, you miss your daddy.
Oh, boy.
Working class support for Wallace was not, however, as solid or extensive as it often appeared in the media. Most of the northern blue-collar support Wallace would claim in the summer of 1968 evaporated in the voting booth. When all the votes were counted and analyzed, it turned out that, in the North, blue-collar workers favored Wallace by only 1 percentage point over white-collar workers. Only in the South was there a major class differential. Blue-collar workers there gave Wallace 42% of their votes, compared to 23% from white-collar people. Even Kevin Phillips, who might have had reason to hope otherwise, concluded that, quote, there was no reliable Wallace backing among blue-collar workers and poor whites as a class. Furthermore, such support as Wallace had among northern workers was not something that genuine conservatives, like Phillips, could easily claim. Polls showed that Wallace voters were far more liberal than Nixon supporters on economic issues, though not on the emerging new social issues. Among Wallace supporters, there was a decisive political cleavage by class, with his blue-collar supporters being more liberal on welfare state issues than his white-collar backers. Also, confusingly, many of those who supported Wallace in the summer of 68 had supported the liberal and adamantly pro-civil rights candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy in the spring, before his assassination abruptly cut off the prospects for a liberal interracial working-class constituency. The working-class support Wallace did attract, transient and, quote, unreliable as it was, only partly reflected a racist backlash against African-American gains. George Corley Wallace was undeniably a high-profile racist and segregationist, but he was also, though many liberals appeared not to notice, a liberal on economic issues. He had been attacked by critics in the Alabama state legislature as downright pink. The economic platform of his American Independent Party stressed expanded social welfare programs and the rights of labor. On the eve of the 1968 election, the head of the American Conservative Union was moved to denounce him as a danger from the left. "True conservatism," he said, "cannot be served by George Wallace. At heart, he is a populist with strong tendencies in the direction of a collectivist welfare state." And this is another universal point between both Democrats and Republicans, dating way far back, at least as far back as the 1890s, is that typically any kind of candidate deemed populist, whether they're George Wallace, whether they're Donald Trump, or whether they're somebody like Jesse Jackson or Bernie Sanders, just kick them out. Just go away. You represent the inner evils of America, whatever nonsense they come up with to say, oh, well, you're a communist or you're a fascist. And it's like, well, sometimes you're right. But also sometimes it's like, okay, what? Is it because it's somebody that actually shakes up the apple cart? Which is why Trump won. Even the national press occasionally caught the leftish undercurrent in Wallace's pitch. As the Washington Post observed, he is talking about poor people, quote, ordinary folks, and if you strip him of the Southern accent and some of the surrounding rhetoric, you might mistake him for a new left advocate of the poverty program, urging the maximum feasible participation of the poor and the return of local government to the people, participatory democracy. Huh. He appealed to the resentments rather than the hopes of the ordinary folks. Only those resentments were not, as many superficially concluded, solely about race. Wallace himself argued that the backlash that he symbolized and fomented sprang from class anger rather than race hatred. "I don't believe there is a backlash in this country against people of color. I think this is a journalistic expression. I think it was coined by the news media." The only real backlash, he believed, was against the theoreticians and the bureaucrats, whose crimes, of course, included school busing and other integrationist measures. In fact, Wallace had dropped overt references to African Americans when he entered the national political scene in 1964. It is true that he didn't have to mention race to get a racist message across. He remained a symbol of intransigent segregationism no matter what he said. But what he did say, in the line of vituperations, was directed almost entirely at the white professional middle class. "The overeducated ivory tower folks with pointed heads looking down their noses at us. The liberals, intellectuals, and long hairs who have run the country for too long. And the intellectual morons with their sissy attitudes." The self-appointed experts and intellectuals had had their day. The people he listened to were, quote, the working man in Ohio, the cab driver in California, the clerk in Indiana. Wallace saw himself leading their revolt against the, quote, phonies, and, quote, social engineers in Washington, whom he promised to throw into the Potomac, along with their briefcases. Who does that remind you of?
Sebastian, I hope you're listening. I hope you hear this. We're gonna drain the swamp, and they're gonna boop, beep, boop, pull the drain, flush.
As much as I can respect the, as much as I can respect the sentiment of Michael Savage's, I'm not Rush Limbaugh, I'm not an empty suit with an empty golf bag,
mm-hmm,
statement on air, which I guess if you're looking at it through like the eyes of like, oh, look at this guy just sticking to his own guns, you know, don't mind the history, but like, look at this guy sticking to his own guns, whom he promised to throw into the Potomac along with their briefcases. If Wallace couldn't drain the swamp, who could? If not you, who?
I am the chosen one.
Well, and this was also the same guy that very, very infamously said, you know, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. So it's, yeah.
If.
Wallace's appeal to class anger worked. A detailed survey of blue-collar Wallace supporters in Gary, Indiana, showed that their strongest resentments were not against African-Americans, though they were indeed strongly resentful of what they perceived as African-American gains, but against the white-collar middle class. Northern Wallaceites often regard their working-class group as unjustly held back in comparison to white-collar workers and professionals. The study concluded, and this class comparison was politically more decisive than racial resentment. In fact, so effective was Wallace's anti-middle-class populism that it was adopted by the party that traditionally represents the professional middle class, the professional middle and upper classes. In the sincerest form of flattery, Vice President Spiro Agnew dedicated himself to attacking the, quote, effete corps of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals.
Sorry, I had to get myself in the moment, because the next section is called Reasons for Anger, and I'm trying to go through my daily affirmations and remain as zen as possible. But even though there is a lot to be angry with in the world, go ahead and open the window and let some of that vitamin D in. Who needs therapy when you have the sun?
Speaking of which, I'm going to get a refill because it's dark out.
Well, while you're gone, I'll go ahead and do my best to read. Reasons for Anger. Much of this chapter has been about the contempt of the middle class for the working class. The insulting stereotypes, the snobbery disguised as sociology, the blindness that allowed the working class to be discovered in the first place. I mean, that really should be on the book jacket. I digress. The most shocking message of the backlash was that the hostility went both ways. To maintain sociologists, working class antagonism to the professional middle class was part of the old American problem of anti-intellectualism, which popped up from time to time among the ignorant and resentful. More sensitive observers in the late 60s and early 70s suggested that there were solid and immediate reasons for working class hostility. One was the war in Vietnam. Poor and working class youths fought. Middle class youths, exempted from service by their student deferrals, were free to protest on college campuses, burn their draft cards, or, if they were of a mind to, the American flag. Another reason for hostility was the long-standing economic disadvantage of working-class Americans, a circumstance that was painfully highlighted, though in opposite ways, by both the civil rights and student movements. Didn't we read this already? I feel like this is the end of the book, and we're just wrapping up here. I know it isn't, but despite the general prosperity of the 60s,
Reagan years to get through.
Yeah, blue-collar workers' real earnings were declining, eaten away in large part by wartime inflation. Say it ain't so. Middle-class liberals had imagined that there was only one disadvantaged group, the poor, which, in the imagery of the late 60s, increasingly meant the African-American poor. The income gap between the middle class and the white blue-collar working class was invisible and usually ignored. And in one of the more socially conscious scenes in Joe, the hero asks his new friend, the executive Bill, "What do you make an hour?" With some amusement, Bill explains that he is paid not by the hour, but by the year. He makes $60,000 a year. Admittedly, a very high executive salary for the time. Oh. Joe makes $4 an hour. Not to break character, but I kind of want to see what that would be like in 2023.
Yeah, because 60K a year now, let's just say there's a lot more 60, I can say about that.
60K a year, that's about what, $25 to $30 an hour?
Say that again. How many dollars an hour? 23 to 25, you said?
25 to 30?
It's closer to 30. I want to say it's like 28, 29.
Okay. Hourly to salary conversion calculator. Indeed, don't let me down. I'm assuming you're working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and you're getting paid hourly $4 an hour, which would equate to $8,320. That's below the poverty line. just a little bit. The fact that the white working class was itself poor relative to the middle class contributed to the tangle of racist and anti-middle class sentiments often expressed. For example, by working class Wallace supporters, go figure. As has been explained many times since the late 60s, it was not middle class suburban liberals who were affected by school busing and other forms of, quote, social engineering. Nor did executives and college professors have much to lose from African American demands for equity in hiring. Most African Americans had no hope of finding a place in the executive suites or faculty lounges. They were aspiring to blue-collar jobs, such as in the building trades, where colorblind hiring would have meant, among other things, that a white worker could no longer expect to pass his job along to his son. This is not to say that white working-class people were or are naturally more racist, because they are more likely to be in contact with African-American people. A common explanation for their presumed higher levels of racism among white workers is that they are likely to be on the front lines of integration. In, quote, changing neighborhoods and in blue-collar work situations where African-Americans might hope to be employed. But a detailed analysis of 1964 survey data showed that among northern manual laborers, those having the most contact with African-Americans in their neighborhoods and jobs were the most favorably disposed toward integration. The highest level of intolerance were found among those northern workers who had the least contact with African Americans. Blue-collar people did not resent middle-class liberals, so much because they were, as Joe would have put it, N-word lovers, but because of their air of moral superiority and contempt for the whites, who would actually have to make room in their schools and workplaces for African-American progress. Finally, economic deprivation gave the working class a very different perspective on the problem of affluence. In the late 60s, affluence was still a vexing issue to intellectuals of the middle class. A goal, certainly, for the poor, but a millstone and possibly a threat to more fortunate Americans. But material excess was not an aching social problem to people who earned $4 an hour, and the tackiness of mass culture was hardly an affront to men, like the plumber quoted by Newsweek, who could not afford a color television set.
Yeah, remember that guy?
Ah, God. In the Gallup poll commissioned by Newsweek, 54% of college students agreed that America was becoming too materialistic, compared to only 36% with a grade school education. And one reason the middle class seemed like snobs was that they appeared so disdainful of the consumer options. The tract house, the matching furniture sets, the second car that the working class still aspired to. As historian William Luckenberg observed, campus sans culottes scoffed at split-level respectability. But workers who had scrimped to achieve lower middle-class status and the appurtenances of the consumer culture felt a fierce protectiveness about their achievements. In fact, very few middle-class adults were sans culottes. And fewer still were prepared to combat affluence by rejecting their own material comforts. But they were, as ever, struggling to redefine the, quote, tasteful away from the common and mass-produced. And as a result, the cultural gap between the classes was beginning to take a new form. Not simply more and more expensive things for the more fortunate, but the contrived appearance of less. For the middle class, a search for tasteful authenticity in red wine and unprocessed food. Oh, God, it's so unprocessed that I can't even pronounce this.
It's basically beef bourguignon.
Why would you spell it that way?
I don't know. It's the French. I did pronounce it wrong. It's sans-culottes.
Sans-culottes.
Yeah.
So beef bourguignon and other foods of peasant providence for the adults, lentils for the young. For the working class, the affordable comforts of Budweiser, tuna casserole, and TV dinners. And if you're like Ryan, phones that go off in the middle of a recording. God, what an age to be alive. Here we are trying to change the world.
My God.
The affordable comforts of Budweiser, tuna casserole, and TV dinners. That sounds pretty good at the moment. If I can't pronounce what I'm eating, I'm not eating it. I don't care how good it looks. Since when does beef have an O in it or a U in it on just
Well, how do
beef?
You think the original word for beef
started? I get it.
I mean,
and
Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah, I understand.
Shia the beef?
Shia the beef.
Believe me, I'm not the first person to realize that. So it was a French student that taught me that. So when I mean a French student, I mean somebody from San Bernardino County that took French. My mom that explained it to me. So,
well, I'd love to antagonize further, but I think that's a pretty good stopping point.
Yeah, the next part of this chapter is a bit long, so I think we picked a good spot to break. But
I can't help but think of the middle to perhaps upper middle class student, son, daughter, child of a non-divorced family that perhaps had a taste of the finer things in life. So right. I'm assuming one or more parents with lengthy disposable income had more money to be concerned with materialist goods and provide their child with the finer things in life. And it often makes me wonder if a child coming from this background ends up going to college, innately becoming liberal, just hypothesizing here. And while they are true to their beliefs in enacting democratically oriented social change, they can't help but think that if they're not at least a smidge Republican like their parents, that they'd end up being cut off. Fewer still were prepared to combat affluence by rejecting their own material comforts. And I'm assuming this is like, from my perspective, like, or for what I'm seeing, at least in this example, like what one has grown up with and what one's, I guess, expectations are. So combating affluence, guessing sticking it to the man to some degree, but yet rejecting their own material comforts, meaning right. that in some way, shape, or form, they somehow embodied the characteristics of the man of being conservatively and fiscally well off by some example. And is there like a political power dynamic in one's own ego in that regard? Like someone who goes to college ends up becoming, let's say, liberal, but has overzealous conservative parents who provided for most of the child's life. Like, does the child feel necessarily willing to give up those material comforts that they've been accustomed to?
It's tricky to say whether or not it's coming from a conservative mindset, only because...
Okay, we'll flip it. If it's
even flipping it, it's still hard because, for one thing, it could be coming from somebody that is, and this is going back to the discussion earlier in the chapter about why do Democrats and Republicans both cater towards saying they're the party for the working class.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's going towards that branch of people, i.e., you know, unfortunately, in Nixon's terms, the quote unquote silent majority that is arguably apolitical, but they are looking out for their own best interests, and they are looking out for the kinds of things that do give them a sense of fulfillment, but also give them a sense of, you know, I'm spending my money and I'm happy about it. It's, and again, it's hard to say what political ideology that comes from outside of it. It's from a very capitalist ideology where it's coming from those comforts that we imagine, or at least at that point in time that people imagined sprung from the 50s, where you had that kind of economic freedom, regardless if you were a liberal or a Republican. I mean, or it was a little different at that time in terms of, you know, what your average conservative was, but certainly if you came from a more liberal New Deal family background versus coming from a more anti-Roosevelt, isolationist, hyper-capitalist background, it was kind of like, yeah, you were probably pretty cool about it because, hey, we beat Hitler. It's the high life, baby. But you fast forward that 20 years, and it's literally just about getting by, and it's not even about It's about getting by, but also having that feeling of, I'm living my life. I don't need the hippies or the Warhawks in my crotch. I can just chill. I think that answered your question.
Yeah, I mean, I was just, kind of. I was mainly asking why one would be unwilling to give up those, like those beliefs, you know, reject or rather material comforts, you know. I look at that statement as someone who's been so inundated with seeing life one particular way that in going to, say, college or finding themselves in a position where they want to suddenly enact more social change, that is it more so of an internal struggle within oneself? Or maybe there's external expectations, say from parents or lifestyle choices that they made in the past where, well, this isn't how I used to be, but now I have this profound interest to, say, help people, you know, sociopolitically. But at the same time, I don't want to give up my material comforts as much as that silently would go against everything that I happen to stand for. So it's a bit tricky to determine what, I guess, how much out of one's comfort zone one is willing to go for sake of, I guess, doing what's right, as well as, I think secretly, like, showboating their accomplishments to some degree, or their material comforts, or their class status in material comforts, you know what I mean? Right. So it sounds very hypocritical to me.
It's hard, too, because we're talking about a country that has repeatedly kicked away any attempt at talking about class seriously, you know, any concept that somebody would actually, you know, go beyond. I mean, again, to read it again, in fact, very few middle class adults were sans-culottes, and fewer still were prepared to combat affluence by rejecting their own material comforts. You could have somebody basically deem themselves their own king of the castle and have zero concept of, well, there's other people that are just like me dealing with their own problems, but they're not spending the way I am, or they're not living the same life as me. So basically there's no sense of solidarity. There's no sense of companionship or relatability. It's all individual. And when that's hammered into you for years and years and years, there won't be any middle-class unity. It's only going to be a bunch of people that are so completely separate and alienated to the point where, you know, it's like today, where it's why you do hear so much about the likes of, you know, people feeling like Travis Bickle or Arthur Fleck or whoever, where it's like there's no sense that people are together in any meaningful way. And it doesn't matter if it's in a political sense or a romantic sense or, you know, a revolutionary sense. It's just, we're all separate. By that definition, it's like, okay, fine, it's every man for himself, then I'm gonna just live out my life as my own king of my own castle. And it's disappointing, but again, this is what you get when you have this, you know, hierarchy that decides, okay, you're all down there, and a couple of us are going to basically control everything, including hold most of the wealth in this country. So it's disappointing, but it's exactly the kind of conditioning, the exact kind of conditioning that we've been forced into. But at the same time, I mean, obviously there are those individuals that you do need to sort of go after and say, what are you doing with yourself? Stop it with the spending, take it easy. But then at the same time, you got to remember there's so many people that it's just a matter of opening doors to them and letting them know that there is something better on the horizon that they can accomplish, that they can do. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of sweat and tears and blood and years, but if successful, it's all worth it. And I think that's always going to be the hard part for people that want to just get out of the monotony of, I'm my own king of my castle. I'm gonna drown myself in Funko Pops or whatever, and not think about the other people that would love to do the same, but they'd also love to, like, have affordable health care and actually be able to buy groceries instead of thinking to themselves, wow, you know, the amount of money just on like 1 week's worth of groceries now is basically like twice as much as it was in 1970.
I'm glad that that was answerable, and that we can go from there.
Do you accept the answer, though, would be my follow-up question. And I'm not being cheeky, but I'm curious what your outlook on the answer is in terms of something that could pull people out of thinking, okay, all I've got is just flooding myself with material minutiae, so therefore that's how I get my fulfillment in an individualized society.
I can't ask this anecdotally.
Right.
Or I can't answer this anecdotally, because the answer, of course, would be no, because I don't agree with that fiscal track record of just overt materialism for sake of, I guess, drowning out an inherently bigger issue. Truth be told, I don't understand why that particular habit of some people exists. And while I can safely say that it's just signs of an outright addiction, I oftentimes wonder what the next steps could be for kicking that, such as someone who wants to give up drinking, smoking, or, I don't know, a sex addiction, for one. And I think with a lot of people, they oftentimes make that justification that if it's my money and I'm earning it, then I should therefore be able to spend it on what I want. And it's this, you mentioned the word cheeky, which is actually the word that I would use here, which is cheeky in and of itself, because it's like they go about it in such like a cutesy actually mindset, which I outright despise, because it lends itself more to the idea of, while an adult perhaps would not want to discuss his or her own salary, it's very much a different story when the individual that you're talking to about their spending habits is not only not an adult of what they're spending on, of what they're spending their money on, but has to go through it in a way where it's like, that's none of your business, actually. And I'm going to go ahead and just cater to my vices without any regard to, you know, looking at my bank account. I don't know if you like stumble across videos where individuals are like showing off how much they spent on their outfit, or, you know, jewelry or whatever, or like when someone's buying shoes, for instance, and they're buying like the Air Force Ones, or I mean, they're shoes. You know, I go back to Shawshank Redemption. So the guards didn't notice at all. You know, after all, seriously, who really takes a look at one's shoes? Where they have this idea, this belief, this pillar, this ideology of, I don't check the bank account because I don't need that negative energy in my life. Is that a fiscally irresponsible outlook? Yes, it is. I'm sorry. Am I a stinker that I have to be the one to address that? Also, yes, because of the implications of someone who doesn't have their habits in check, you know, because I've seen the negative implications of what that can lead to.
Right.
So to answer your question, no, anecdotally.
And I know this is something that we've talked about on Mars on Life multiple times, where if you've got, you know, a community of people, a society of people that are so over inundated with just being told that, like, oh, just having the most means you're at your best.
Right.
Or you are the best, when the reality of it is that you do realize there's other people actually in the same boat as you. They may not look as affluent as you do, but they're in exactly the same boat as you, and they're struggling arguably just as much as you are. You know, why not do something about it? Why not do some kind of mutual aid or whatever? And you don't see that just because, again,
because people would rather have their materialism than look out to the next guy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You're asking if I agree with that, or if I had any further thoughts on that, or
any further thoughts, but also like if there's any, well, it would be naive of me to say, oh, is there any possibility of that being undone? Because let's face it, we've had
Okay, no, that's
I certainly don't feel optimistic that there is a way for that to be undone, but
that
I don't
is an interesting
hope in thinking it can be undone.
That's an interesting discussion, though. And actually, that's a great point to end off on, because in a perfect world, yes, where individuals would need to have their spending habits be checked. I mean, come on, who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want a financially literate society where understanding the causes and effects of, say, hyperinflation, printing money, for example, perhaps not spending your money on necessary attributes to live for sustenance.
But even that's difficult.
Potentially creating affordable housing.
Yeah.
Can it be undone? Not without a series of checks and balances in place that I can tell both sides of the aisle are going to absolutely love, because what we love more than overzealous politics is an invisible hand coming in our wallets, telling us how to spend our money. Nobody likes to be told how to spend their money, as much as I believe sometimes it's necessary when you go too far over the edge in your spending habits. And in creating a society that understands that, I don't think we're going to see that in this lifetime.
I agree.
Because if capitalism is the supposed best system for be-all, end-all, winners versus losers strategy of here's how money in the economy works, do with it what you will, the whole class disparity that, I mean, this is how much we've read in the whole book so far, the whole class disparity ongoing discussion that we've read and commentated about ad nauseum, that sort of has to exist in order for capitalism to function. Because there has to be apparent haves and have-nots, especially regarding money.
It's a vampire that, you know, benefits some but leaves everyone else totally in the dust to die.
Now, morally, of course, it's not the correct way to go about it, but I don't think that this is necessarily a discussion about morality as it is a discussion about practicality. Can we see it in this lifetime? Not in mine and not in yours.
And I do think
that's unfortunate.
You had another point that I was going to address, but I'm tired and I don't remember now what it was.
Beautiful.
Well, listeners.
If there's anything else, and I know that there's not, go ahead, you can end it.
That's been episode 9, I believe, of Falling Middle Cast. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Falling Middle Cast. Our co-hosts are Ryan Mancini and Sebastian Shug. Episodes are produced by Ryan Mancini and feature music by Kevin MacLeod. Check out our main series, Mars on Life, or listen to our other spinoff, Diet NIMBY, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.